This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Eggland's Best.
I'm Stacey Lynn. Another group of hostages is expected to be released at some point today, and for the first time, an American is on the list. But National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told CBS's Face the Nation he's being cautious about the impending release.
But implementation of something as intricate and complicated as this is difficult, and so until we actually see it happen, we are going to remain cautious in what we say, and that's why I'm not being more forward-leaning in indicating what's happening with an American citizen coming out today.
After hostages are released, they're being taken to hospitals to be checked. Silvana Fennig is with Snyder Children's Medical Center.
The children and their family members are in good physical condition. It's too early to tell more about their emotional condition.
While the four-day pause in fighting is expected to end tomorrow, Qatar, which helped mediate the deal between Israel and Hamas, says it hopes it will be extended. Pope Francis is under the weather. CBS's Anna Matrenga is in Rome.
Pope Francis is suffering from a lung infection, which has caused him to cancel activities over the last 2 days. On Saturday, the Vatican announced the Pope had a mild flu and that a CT scan had been performed to rule out pulmonary complications. On Sunday, Francis did not deliver his usual noon blessing, but remained seated next to an aide who delivered it instead.
Our waistlines may be a bit bigger from the big Thanksgiving feast and all the leftovers. Now it's time to head home.
As we get ready to hit the highways or the skyways to get back home, there is a storm system moving east along a lengthy north-south line, featuring a lot of rain in its southern part and snow up north. Not really heavy, but just enough.
These early season snowfall events can creep up on some people and lead to some more treacherous driving conditions than, say, midwinter.
But National Weather Service meteorologist Cody Snell does add,
we're going to see precipitation totals kind of lowering and weakening, but still some light snowfall possible as we move into Illinois, parts of the Midwest, and then the Great Lakes by the end of the weekend into early next week.
Tom Foti, CBS News.
Well, maybe you're out shopping for a Christmas tree today.
If you're in the market for a real tree this season, Jill Sidebottom with the National Christmas Tree Association has some advice.
We recommend that if you have a certain type of tree or size of tree that you want, that you shop early.
And be flexible about that highest bow.
Well, Black Friday and Small Business Saturday were successful.
We come here, get Santa photos, get our hot cocoa, and just make sure to have fun.
And with the holiday season in full swing now, spending will continue tomorrow with Cyber Monday. This is CBS News.
Eggland's Best. The only eggs with more fresh and delicious taste, plus superior nutrition. Because the way we care is anything but ordinary. Only Eggland's Best.
I'm Dr. Stork. Eggs are...
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than the gospel.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new survey finds immigrant students need better help in school. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
The Youth Truth Reimagining Migration Survey was designed to examine the perspective of immigrant students as to how they're doing in school. The survey finds immigrant students don't feel they can be themselves there. There was also middling scores when asked if they feel like part of their school's community. Adam Strom with Reimagining Migration describes the importance of an immigrant student's native language to their education.
If you're in a school where folks are encouraging you to speak your own home language when appropriately, your school experience is much better. You have a much stronger sense of belonging. You have a much stronger sense that your peers like you. You see yourselves in textbooks more. You see yourself in the classroom more in what's being taught.
He notes if schools take the opposite approach, this can increase a student's sense of isolation. While there has been more attention paid to immigrant students' mental health, cultural and attitudinal barriers like stigma remain a factor. Though there are ways to ensure immigrant students feel included, there are some challenges to making these work. Along with anti-immigrant sentiments flooding the country, teacher shortages mean educators can't be one-on-one with their students. But Jimmy Simpson Jr. with Youth Truth says another factor is that immigrant students are more than immigrants.
So thinking that there are migrant students also part of the LGBTQ community, Black immigrant students or brown or BIPOC immigrant students, they have very different types of experiences than a migrant student who may be white.
Simpson adds, seeing people beyond just being immigrants goes a long way to creating a welcoming environment for immigrant students in schools. This is Edwin J. Vieira. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Snow today, additional accumulation under an inch. We'll see high temperatures in the lower 30s, breezy winds as they'll turn to the northwest in the afternoon. Overnight, mostly cloudy skies, blustery with lows dropping to the middle teens. It's 24 at our studios.
On air, 93.5 FM. Online, thetap.com. And on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and this is our Saturday morning broadcast. Today is November 25th, 2023. This is our 73rd broadcast on the wonderful stations of Civic Media statewide. As always, you've joined us this morning for our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important news stories, those events, those occurrences, those happenings in our lives in the areas of law and government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya. We're here in the studios of Waukesha, but broadcasting throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond, taking your questions, your comments, specifically your inquiries about things we're talking about. That phone number is 844-967-2789. You can also go on the Civic Media website, find your broadcast station, and find Morning Cannoli, and find us and send us a note. Send us a question, a comment, and we'll take those also as a part of our discussion this morning. At the end of our first hour this morning, doing a bit of review of those many cases pending right now in the state and federal courts involving a candidate for the presidency in this calendar year and also especially next calendar year, 2024. His name, of course, is Donald Trump, focused in part upon this upcoming damages case involving E. Jean Carroll in the civil court in New York in January, the continuing New York State valuations case, the property case involving not only Donald Trump and his sons, but also the corporation itself, that ongoing in front of a state civil judge. His name is Arthur Engoron. And then we have these four major criminal matters also pending in courts around our nation. What's the schedule on those right now as we approach, but not at the end of the calendar year, in mid-March or so, the January 6th election interference case. This is the big one. This is the one brought by the U.S. Department of Justice, naming Donald Trump alone as a singular defendant, four different counts alleging election interference, deprivation of civil rights as well. That going to trial before Judge Tanya Chutkan in the District of Columbia District Court in March of 2024. That same month, in Manhattan, a criminal case, a state criminal case. This is the hush money case involving the election of 2016 brought by Alvin Bragg, who's the DA there. That's also still in the books for March of 2024. May of 2024, the classified documents case in Florida, pending right now before a district court judge back in federal court here, Eileen Cannon. She's got that right now scheduled for May of 2024. That's a case involving classified and other presidential documents taken, allegedly taken by the former president, brought to that location, other locations in violation, according to the indictment there, in violation of federal law. That one going to trial presumably in May of 2024. And then we got this request coming from the district attorney. Her name is Fonnie Willis in Fulton County, asking that the Georgia election interference case, this is a state criminal prosecution against Donald Trump, and now about 15 other defendants, four of them have pled guilty, alleging interference with the election there in the state of Georgia, an omnibus sweeping RICO case. She has asked, that is, the prosecutor has asked, for the trial to begin in August of 2024, and also indicated that case will not likely resolve anytime in the coming calendar year. We'll see how all of these calendar dates play out. Of course, 2024, as we indicate in connection with our own discussion of voting rights in America, these federal cases coming out of states to the south, coming out of our own state of Wisconsin, all of that implicating voting rights in America, voting rights here in Wisconsin, voting rights for everyone who cares about democracy and the republic. And that is and should be all of us, of course. A lot going on, of course, all those trials happening in the midst of a campaign, including things like Super Tuesday, including things like the conventions of the major Republican and Democratic parties happening in Milwaukee and Chicago in the summer of this coming year. And then, of course, the election in November of 2024. Lots going on in 2024, including a lot of discussion about the interaction between the First Amendment, the capacity of a candidate for the presidency to advocate for his own return to the White House, that is Donald Trump, which plainly he has the right to do under the First Amendment. But where are the restrictions on that? Where are the limits of that when it comes to the fact that he is also a defendant in at least two, if not more, of these cases? Two of these cases right now prompting review by appellate courts about the extent to which the First Amendment does not give the defendant, Donald Trump, the right to comment about things going on in connection with the trial itself. In particular, an awful lot of thoughtful focus on whether or not, and my answer is not, does not permit a candidate to impugn the integrity of witnesses, to affect the potential jury pool, things that go right to the very credibility of the litigation itself, the criminal prosecution, both the prosecution and the defense of those cases. We want everything to be fair and decent on both sides, administered by, overseen by a federal judge, by a state court judge in New York, by a federal judge in Washington, D.C. Both of those judges have imposed, if you will, these so-called gag orders. Again, a piece of language I'm not especially attracted to because it suggests that somehow you're violating First Amendment rights. You're not. You're simply imposing limited restrictions on the First Amendment by someone who happens to be running for the presidency. What? To both acknowledge that he does have rights under the Constitution, to speak generally about his candidacy, including things like the representation which he has made, his feeling that these prosecutions are not well-founded, that perhaps they're the product of some political animus. He can say that in the public domain. What he can't say, what he should not be able to say, is to talk about the specifics of, for example, people once again who are testifying in those trials, including arguably his own former vice president, Mike Pence, who will very much be likely a witness in the federal insurrection, the interference case in Washington, D.C. Shouldn't be able to testify about Mark Milley, the former chief of staff of the armed services, who will also likely be a candidate. Other people, arguably the former attorney general, Bill Barr, all these people coming in, commenting about their credibility when that has the potential to affect the presentation, the balanced presentation in court, and also, as some of the judges have indicated, affect the very jury pool. The important aspect of these cases are going to be decided by members of a jury pulled in from the community. And if that pool is somehow infected by these statements made outside of court about witnesses, about the conduct of the judges, the prosecutors, even defense counsel, all of that has an implication for the legitimacy of those proceedings. That shouldn't happen. And yet, as the courts are wrestling right now, do not want to shut down a candidate for any office, including the presidency. Don't want to shut down anybody when it comes to legitimate exercises of their First Amendment rights. And that's the question. Where do you draw these lines between those two not really competing aspects of our First Amendment, but recognizing, as we've said so often on this broadcast, that the First Amendment, like all other rights established for us in our federal and indeed our state constitutions, none of those is unconditional. all of those subject to restrictions and limitations. Why? Because we live in a community of people and we care for each other. And there are things we necessarily give up in order to live in a community of women and men, girls and boys who live together in a hopefully productive society. That's the reason why our rights are established, but also limited, including the right under our First Amendment to speak, to assemble, to petition government, free speech, freedom of press, all those kinds of things established by our First Amendment, other provisions, of course, in that First Amendment as well. We know from just this past week that the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia is now wrestling with whether or not the so-called order limiting the candidate, Donald Trump, from talking about court staff. She specifically, that is Tanya Chutkan, limited the defendant from maligning prosecutors and potential witnesses or court employees involved in the case. The Court of Appeals just this past week entertaining oral argument on whether or not that particular order can stand and what are the limits of what a president candidate can and cannot do in the public domain. All of that before the Court of Appeals, presumably going to be issuing an order sometime very soon about all of that. The appellate judges in that particular forum appear to be seeking some way to balance between the integrity of the election interference case, as we've talked about it, and the people involved in it, those witnesses, the jurors, the court staff themselves, while also preserving Donald Trump's rights to respond in public to denunciations by his political adversaries or critics. How do you balance those two things? Again, some of those witnesses likely to be include Vice President, former Vice President Mike Pence, people like Bill Barr, Mark Milley, others involved in those cases. A lot of discussion this past week, not only about the limits of what a court, a federal court, can do. This same issue also pending in a state court in New York, also an appellate court having to do with a decision made by Justice Arthur Engoron. He's a judge presiding over the state valuations case. He also prohibited Donald Trump from talking about court staff, in particular, the court's law clerk. The clerk, having suffered some repeated attacks by the former president and his allies, who accused her of being a Democratic partisan in that case. That case also pending in front of another appellate court in New York, wrestling with the same kinds of issues, predictions coming out of the oral arguments, likely a definition, if you will, that does indeed embrace some First Amendment rights of a presidential candidate to be out there to advocate on behalf of his candidacy. And yes, indeed, to comment in general terms, very broadly, his views about the legitimacy of the prosecutions of him without going into specific attacks on court staff, prosecutors, even defense attorneys. The courts probably will let the candidate, Donald Trump, continue those attacks upon the prosecutors. Having been in position myself as a U.S. attorney, that sort of comes with the job. You're going to take some attacks in the public domain by virtue of being a public official, a public figure. But what we cannot countenance is the notion that we would have attacks upon witnesses, attacks upon the process itself, the jury system, and the very integrity. That's what the courts of appeals are wrestling with. We'll see in the days ahead, presumably just the weeks ahead, what those courts of appeals do in the state system, the federal system, as they direct what a presidential candidate can and cannot say under the Constitution of the United States, the laws of our country, when it comes to legitimacy of our criminal prosecutions, both state and federal. Stay with us right after this first break for more discussion, including comments from some of our listeners. Stay with us for that important discussion.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station, the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
I'm not even clear from conflicting headlines whether or not Robin Voss has the cojones
to move forward with impeachment against Meghan Mullen. Why would he do such a thing? You know, just a couple of weeks after he said he wasn't going to do such a thing. Well, he's been threatened, huh? By what? A group headed by his primary opponent, Adam Steed.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast talking about law and government and, yes, the aspiration for justice in America. As always, delighted to have you participate in our discussion, specifically with your questions, your inquiries about things on our syllabus this morning. That number, of course, 844-967-2789. You can also go online and text to Anya and to me your questions, your inquiries about the subject matter of our discussion this morning and every morning here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We have some of those wonderful callers online right now. Joe, delighted to have you with us from Madison once again this morning. And your question, your comment, your observation for consumption by us here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Well, just to reiterate, from your first hour, you brought up two particular cases. The first was the case out of the Fifth Circuit Court, and this looked at Voting Rights Act and said we're going to curtail some access that people have had in the past. Only governments may bring cases that have to do with problems with voting rights. And previously held that individuals or nonprofit groups could petition to have this looked at. We're getting rid of that idea in this Fifth Circuit opinion. And then we also have this situation of the gerrymandering arguments heard in Wisconsin. And I find it sadly hysterical and pathetic that the Republican Supreme Court Justice Ms. Bradley, Rebecca Bradley, is saying the words to the effect, how many times are we going to keep going back to gerrymandering in Wisconsin? Is there no end? We must have finality with these decisions. Are you kidding me? I mean, if we had finality with decisions, then the abortion law that we've had for 50 years wouldn't have been undone by the Dobbs decision. And if we had finality in law, we wouldn't be going back to this decision in the Fifth Circuit that you mentioned in the same half hour, where voting rights, the Voting Rights Act established who could petition to get a redress of grievances has been curtailed so that individuals and nonprofits can't do that anymore. What is she out of her mind? She was former Supreme Court Justice, and she doesn't have a sense that we're always going back to the law, always going back to the law. When has it ever been that it's final? Anyway, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this.
Joe, always so appreciate your very thoughtful observations. And Leah, let's take that up. It is an important issue. There certainly, as you have implicitly acknowledged, there are reasons for the law to be settled. And indeed, we've got the Voting Rights Act of 1965, right? We've had 35 years under the 20th century, 23 more years under the 21st century. We've always had this notion that you can, in fact, petition for redress of grievances under the Voting Rights Act if you're a private citizen, a private group. Again, now the Eighth Circuit, as you indicated just this past week, certainly for the Eighth Circuit, a real change in the law. We'll see if it changes the law nationwide. Hopefully those will come to the Supreme Court. And our anticipation is that the Supreme Court, this Supreme Court panel, will overturn the Eighth Circuit and say, no, we're going to continue with what has been our tradition in this nation for a long period of time. There is some sense, as you indicate, Joe, some sense of finality. At the same time, I could not embrace more your notion, as we have talked in so many circumstances in the past, the notion that our Constitution, and yes, even the interpretation of our laws, even this discussion about contiguity in before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, it should be a part of a fluid and not every day changing, but it should be evolutionary in the sense that as our nation changes, as our social structures change, as our perspectives about life and livelihood change, our Constitution, our understanding of what that is all about should change as well. We know that we are no longer the nation that saw the production of our wonderful Constitution 250 years ago, and it has been interpreted dramatically, significantly, much to my approval and the approval of most other people in this in our nation, to ensure a greater understanding, a greater embracing of rights, of civil rights, of human rights. That's a good thing, both in terms of amendments to the Constitution, interpretations of that. And that notion that you have underscored, Joe, about the importance of consistently testing, if you will, whether our nation continues to be one of laws and what those laws should mean in a contemporary society, that's an all-important issue as well. Those two things are not necessarily in conflict. The notion of having law settled and yet at the same time, at appropriate times in our history, revisiting what is and is not our proper understanding about how we should live our lives. Those things are a part of our system. We embrace the notion that there are people arguing these cases, both for and against the evolution of the laws, returning it to the way that it should be, perhaps embracing new visions of laws. All of those things are part of our system. What the underlying predicate for all of that is a system of rule of law that commands, that requires that we have judges and justices, yes, at Supreme Court levels, both in the state and the federal system, who are free of impulses based upon personal relationships. Their biases are put aside, and what they do is they examine what a living constitution, living states of laws should be all about, and ensure that the rule of law is impressed upon all of us through the decisions that they make. Those are decisions that bring to balance both a reverence for history, but also, Joe, as you indicated, some change as we go forward. The observations you make about the arguments along the way seeming to be contrary to one or both of those principles, yes, much noted by not only you, but others around our nation, certainly around our state. Joe, as always, appreciate your comments and your questions on our morning broadcast. We also have Earl calling in this morning. Earl, appreciate your comment or your question this morning on our broadcast.
Hey, good morning, my friend, Attorney Santillo.
And Earl, I am so glad to hear your good voice this morning on our broadcast this morning. It has been much too long since you and I have chatted. Glad to have you with me this morning, my friend.
Well, I have to say to you that it is frustrating for me, and I'm sure many others, as we talk about our Constitution, we talk about all of these other things, and yet there's a man named Donald Trump who seems to, I didn't realize that the Constitution shows deference to someone who's running for president of the United States. I didn't think that our Constitution could point out an individual, and we're more concerned about the Constitution is more concerned about that individual rights than the entire population of the American people. And so the more I hear, well, we can't do this. We've got to be protective of the rights of a man who's running for president of the United States. I thought the Constitution was more concerned about all of us and less concerned about individuals, because if there was anyone other than Donald Trump who was doing the shenanigans that he's doing inside court, we would all face punishment for that. But yet our government and our Constitution judicial system doesn't seem to be able to handle. What can you explain to me why that is?
And Earl, first of all, thank you so much for calling in. Could not get a better question, because believe it or not surprisingly, that's next on my agenda as well. I want to go to a break right now. Would you stay on the line, my friend Earl? And we're going to talk more about this important question you've raised. That is the seeming tension between the Constitution, First Amendment rights, somebody running for the presidency. And let's tease this by simply saying that many of these judges have also said this particular defendant entitled to no more rights than any other defendant who would appear. Let's talk about that right after this break here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Been sitting here. Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the Valley and all of Wisconsin. In fact, it's on tap every day. This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Qatar's Prime Minister has just told CBS has faced the nation that a four-year-old Israeli-American girl appears to be on the list of Hamas hostages to be released today.
We are hoping that we will see the release happening shortly, and within the list, they include Abigail, the young girl, 4 years old.
Small businesses are expected to do about $125 billion in business this holiday season. Alex S.A. Paul manages a coffee shop in Topeka, Kansas.
Big businesses online, they're not going to notice when you make a purchase, but like if we have a really great day here, it could just like change somebody's life.
If you're headed home from the holidays, CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson has a look at some of what to expect.
For your Sunday, it's a Midwestern trouble spot to start, and then the day likely ends with rain and sloppy conditions in the east.
You know, the forecast looks pretty good from Colorado to the West Coast. CBS News Brief, I'm Peter King.
Badgers win back the axe. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers beat Minnesota 28-14 in Minneapolis. That's the sound of the Badgers offensive line chopping down the Gophers' goalposts with Paul Bunyan's axe after the game. Wisconsin head coach Luke Fickle.
That was a special night. That was a special game. I got to give it to our guy. I mean, the heart, the soul, the grit. But I just mean that the ability to sustain some things, because at the end of the year, we all know there's nicks and bruises. There's guys that are hurt. There's plenty of guys that I said there's no way they would have played today, and they did.
The Badgers now 7-5 and wait for a bowl bid. The Gophers finish at 5-7. Head coach P.J. Fleck.
Sorry, we weren't able to give you the year that you all probably really wanted. There's a lot of things. And I mean, at one point, there were six freshmen on that defense on the field at one time today. That's not where you want to be, and there's a lot of reasons for that.
That's Minnesota head coach P.J. Fleck. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. No today, additional accumulation under an inch. We'll see high temperatures in the lower 30s, breezy winds as they'll turn to the northwest in the afternoon. Overnight, mostly cloudy skies, blustery with lows dropping to the middle teens. It's 24 at our studios.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Guys doing chores. How would that do on TikTok?
Sounds like you should be wearing like short shorts or something.
We're not going to exploit you in that way. I think it's more about your Q-tip action and
phrasing, Jane. The way you're saying it just sounds like one big double entendre.
Delicately in the crevices.
Oh, God. Okay.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
The Green Bay Packers call Lambeau Field home, but did you know the stadium has a history all its own? It started with where to build it. Residents on both sides of the city wanted it. Officials argued there had to be room for growth. Eventually, farmland was purchased, but in Ashwaubenon. The bargaining continued, and in 1956, the land was annexed to Green Bay. Green Bay City Stadium became a reality the following year and was renamed in honor of team co-founder and coach Curly Lambeau in 1965. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Ball.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Maybe we'll have a cookie trade.
I like that idea. I like that a lot.
We'll eat them while we're on the show.
Because everyone loves listening to people on the radio eat.
Calvin, what's your favorite cookie?
Shout out to my mom's. She makes these sour cream cookies around Christmas time, and they're really good.
My mouth just watered.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Devil's Advocates radio show.
Chris from Middleton. Welcome to the show. What do you got for us?
I'm a Democrat. I totally agree that there's been too much corporate influence probably in the Democratic Party. I liked how Bernie talked about economic issues, and I agree with you more of that. But I don't think we can also afford to shy away from the identity politics. In fact, we got to lean into the identity politics and not be shy about it.
The Devil's Advocates radio show. Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. It's tearing up my heart when I'm
with you. But when we are, and we are back in our Saturday morning broadcast, and I am honored to be joined by one of our icons here in Civic Media, an icon in Wisconsin radio. His name is Earl Ingram. Earl, thank you so much for joining me this morning and also for your especially thoughtful comment about this question that's also before the Court of Appeals and the District of Columbia Circuit Court and also the Appellate Court in New York. This question about what kind of special deference, if any, should be given to someone who is a defendant in a civil and a criminal case. When it comes to their First Amendment rights, what kinds of things should we be thinking about when it comes to ensuring their First Amendment rights are protected and yet the integrity of our legitimate judicial system is also preserved? I want to tell you, Earl, that you have taken a page from the things that the judges themselves have said, both the district court judges and the appellate court judges, who've often said, you know, if you appear in front of my court, you're going to be handled no differently than any other defendant. Earl, as you know, I spent about 30 years of my life doing criminal prosecution, civil litigation on the prosecution side criminally and the civil side, both defensively and affirmatively. When we had juries, when we had decisions to be made by the courts, we often talked about the importance of ensuring an accurate, a proper, a decent delivery of justice for the defendant. And that meant that all the rules apply to this defendant as they do to any other defendant who would appear. Tanya Chutkan has said just that during the course of her trying to wrestle with this issue. And yet, I think, Earl, your point is well taken, that the district court, the trial court judges here, are giving him an awful lot more leeway than he would otherwise be granted. He is still out there, as earlier you've said, making comments in our national conversation on his own Truth Social platform as well, talking about the very people he's prohibited from talking about. And that's prompting, again, as yesterday, we still have Jack Smith running back into court saying, see, he's doing more of this. We've got to wrestle this under control. I agree with you that the Constitution, important for everyone, including a criminal defendant, a civil defendant, nonetheless should not give way to the greater concern that all of us have, the public has, in the integrity of our system. And so, Earl, I appreciate your comment and your thoughts more from you, my friend, about things that are animating this all-important discussion about who we are as America.
You know, Attorney, he clearly has made a mockery of our justice system. And so when you have other Americans who now are looking to support him in what he's doing, he's attempting to destroy the justice system. Once you destroy the justice system of our nation, what do you replace it with?
Right.
So for all these people who are now saying, you know, I'm opposed to this, I'm opposed to that, I don't trust the system, what happens to our government?
Right.
Without the justice system, you know, what do we really have?
Right. Exactly. And we've talked about this. You and I have privately and on the air as well. It's nothing short of the future of the republic. Right. We depend upon all branches of government, our executive branches, right, our legislative branches, certainly the judiciary also, to not only decide cases, but tell us what the law is. That's the great long term impact of this. Right. Among other things, as you and I have discussed,
sir.
Earl, you know, if someone looks at defendant Trump and says, gee, he is out there saying things about the witnesses, about the jury, about participants in the trial. Why can't I do that in my case? Right. That's the deterrent. And that's the impact of a decision that restricts him from doing those things. That's the great concern. That's the great concern that you're articulating. If these appellate judges, the appellate panels, do not say, you know what, you are like every other defendant. We'll give you some appropriate First Amendment protections, but not all the things you want. His attorneys, believe it or not, in front of the D.C. Appellate Court have said he should have unfettered rights under the First Amendment to say whatever he wants. That can't be the law, right, Earl? That can't be the position. And that's, if in fact that is embraced by anybody out there, including judges, that's when the republic does begin to fall. That's the great concern.
So my last thing is, he's a private citizen. He's
yes.
not the president. You know, and so he should be treated as a private citizen. And even if he was the president, that's my issue. You know, where does it say deference to that person? And unless we are willing to, the justice system itself is willing to take this on and be damned about the criticisms that they'll receive, I think it endangers the entire system.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Right. Earl, always good to hear from you. Call in anytime, my friend, and we'll talk further about those important issues. Appreciate very much your contribution to our discussion this morning on the Saturday morning broadcast. Looking forward to hearing from you again this coming week on Civic Media as well. And to Earl, your last point there as well, the Constitution does not carve anything out for someone who happens to be running for the presidency. James Madison did not anticipate this particular situation. Certainly people running for the presidency, yes, but not at the same time contemporaneously being brought into court by virtue of grand jury indictments, being brought to answer for their allegedly criminal conduct. This is an issue, we hesitate to say it's unprecedented because that's a word that's bandied about much too much currently, but it truly is. And so we've got these judges at the appellate level, the state in New York, the federal court in Washington, D.C., wrestling for the first time with what this means. And hopefully, much to Earl's good recommendation and suggestion, finding that this particular defendant, Donald Trump, who is a private citizen today, is entitled to no more, no less than any other defendant would be in any civil or criminal court in our land. Earl, as always, thank you for your thoughtful comments, questions. Let's spend some time, as I promised, talking more about our Supreme Court. Supreme Court back in business this coming week, a number of oral arguments, a number of different cases. I'll highlight them so that you can know the kinds of things our Supreme Court is addressing on a regular basis. To this morning, it decided to hear about 44 different cases from around the circuits, and yes, indeed, some state courts as well, could potentially include among the, say, 20 or more cases it may yet grant certiorari about taking those cases on. Could in the end grant cert decide to hear the Wisconsin Supreme Court case that we talked about earlier? It has this coming week a number of cases pending before it. One of them on Monday, the 27th, a case called Brown versus U.S., Jackson versus U.S., coming out of the 3rd and 11th circuits, having to do with something called the serious drug offense definition under the Armed Career Criminal Act, the kind of thing that we dealt with on a regular basis, prosecutors still deal with on a regular basis when it comes to not only charging but sentencing and the understanding of that Armed Career Criminal Act. It's 18 U.S.C. Section 924 in the federal court. There's another case coming up on Tuesday called McElrath versus Georgia. It has to do with a double jeopardy clause coming out of the Georgia Supreme Court, a defendant who suffered what are called inconsistent verdicts from a jury, and whether or not the return to the criminal prosecution of him in that case violates the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution. Whole lot more complicated than that summary description of it. We'll talk more about it perhaps next week. There's also another case coming out of the Third Circuit, also up for oral argument on Tuesday, having to do with an agency determination about a particular set of facts and whether they're exceptional and rise to the level of extremely unusual hardship. Again, a particular legal standard coming out of the Third Circuit, cases Wilkinson versus Garland. And that case having to do with an agency determination leads me into yet another case that's coming up for discussion and oral argument this coming Wednesday that goes to this larger issue that the United States Supreme Court is wrestling with in this term, unmistakably focused upon the role, the legitimacy, the constitutionality of our federal agencies. And yes, that's right, on the 29th of November, this coming Wednesday, the United States Supreme Court is going to be entertaining a case called SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, versus Jareski. Jarchese. The respondent's name is George Jarchese. It comes out of this particular facts scenario, and it comes out of the Fifth Circuit. Not surprisingly, once again, a case coming out of the Fifth Circuit. The SEC brought what's called an administrative proceeding against Mr. Jarchese and his advisory firm, a thing called Patriot 28. This is way back in 2013, about 10 years ago. And that particular administrative action by this administrative agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, was for violating some securities laws in the management of some hedge funds. Charkhazy sued the SEC in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia on the grounds that the agency's structure violates the Constitution. The district court dismissed the case, said, no, this agency's around since the 1930s. Nothing about its constitution, about the way that it was enacted by the legislature, is violative of the federal constitution, dismissed that case. And the SEC continued with these administrative proceedings, assigned this case to an administrative law judge who found that Mr. Charkhazy and his group, the Patriot 28 advisory firm, had violated the securities laws. And so we lost initially both on the substance of these particular charges brought by the SEC and also under this broader attack against the very authority, the propriety of the SEC even acting in this area at all. The commission reviewed the decision, determined that Charkhazy and his advisory firm had violated the Securities Act, the Exchange Act, something called the Advisors Act, and he was ordered to pay about $300,000 in civil penalties and to cease and desist from these violations. All this civil and proceeding, this is not a criminal case, but an administrative proceeding happening under the auspices of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Well, what happens is Mr. Charkhazy, once again, dissatisfied with both the substantive ruling and also this determination that the SEC is legitimate, brings his case to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And a divided panel of that particular court holds that the SEC's, the layers of removal protections from the president's oversight unconstitutionally insulated those ALJs, the administrative law judges, from presidential oversight. And because of that, because of the way that the SEC has been constituted and acting, that is the separation from presidential oversight, that in and of itself is a basis for finding that the SEC was unconstitutionally, illegally put together way back when. And there's more. There's more the Fifth Circuit found. It also found that the agency's adjudication proceedings, the mechanisms by which it makes these decisions in Mr. Charkhazy's case, but also other proceedings, unconstitutionally violated the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. And the Fifth Circuit goes on also to say that the Congress's unconstitutionally delegated legislative power to the SEC accomplished yet another illegal conveyance of authority and power to the SEC. Why? By failing to provide the agency with an intelligible principle or set of doctrines by which it would be guided in its enforcement of the SEC laws itself. Basically, the Fifth Circuit says the SEC, in place for 90 years, unconstitutionally in place, unlawful, Mr. Charkhazy is right. His case should be dismissed. His findings of inappropriate conduct are unfounded, and the SEC should be disbanded. The door is closed on that. Well, the Supreme Court decided to take that case up. And indeed, this coming Wednesday, in this case involving Mr. Charkhazy, SEC versus Charkhazy, is determining whether or not the SEC is a legitimate organization. That oral argument coming up again just this coming week before the United States Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is not done in this area, granting review, hopefully, to set the Fifth Circuit straight. And to say that, yes, indeed, the SEC does have a legitimate authorization by the legislature, does have the right to do what it does do. And the Fifth Circuit's decision about its inadequacies in these various areas are unfounded. Hopefully, that will be the decision. We'll hear about that, however, during the course of the oral argument coming up this coming Wednesday. The Supreme Court, however, is not only focusing on that particular case, but other cases as well pending before the Supreme Court, even right now as we speak. We have talked before about at least one of those, the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That case we're going to revisit right after this break. And then we're going to talk about a huge case, no oral argument set, but it underscores this general focus that the Supreme Court is having these days on reviewing the legitimacy, the constitutionality, the rightness of our administrative agencies in America in these early years of the 21st century. Stay with us for that discussion right after this very brief break. And no matter what I do, I feel the
This is 93.5 The Tap.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back in this, our final segment on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about the Supreme Court and this stretch of cases that the Supreme Court, your United States Supreme Court, is taking up that go to the very legitimacy of what's called our administrative state, which is also a part of the present presidential and even local, county, and state elections about whether or not our agencies are legitimate. That, these are the people, these are civil servants who are the experts. They're the scientists. They're the mathematicians. They're the medical people, the educated people, the folks who know what they're talking about. And the question is whether or not the agencies are properly constituted. And as we're going to see in a minute, whether or not the deference that has historically been granted to the agencies, that is the people who do these things without political animation, without a partisan view, whether those views should not get the deference that they have gotten, quite literally for decades in America. We talked before about a second case now pending before the Supreme Court, CFPB, in before the United States Supreme Court, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau case against the Community Financial Services Association. This is the second case argued before the Supreme Court way back in October, determining whether or not the CFPB, which is, again, this organization designed in the wake of the 2007 financial crisis to address issues related to consumer protection issues, whether it itself was properly constituted back then. And the question in that case was whether or not, because it's receiving funding directly from the Federal Reserve and not appropriations from our Congress, whether that renders its very existence invalid. The challengers in that case said because Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution requires appropriations, the money part of the Constitution, any monies drawn from the Treasury, those supporting agencies, for that reason, the CFPB, which gets its funding not from appropriations but rather from the Federal Reserve, unconstitutional. That's the allegation. That's the claim that's made. Appears from the oral argument way back in early October that the Supreme Court is not buying into that notion, that they're going to find that, yes, indeed, the CFPB was legitimately constituted. Could comment along the way about these kinds of things, the way that the agency here was created. We hope that the SEC, maybe at the same time, will also survive its present challenge, also coming out of the Fifth Circuit. Both of these cases, again, the CFPB case and the SEC, coming out of these sort of peculiar decisions of the Fifth Circuit, finding the agencies do not have legitimacy that we've thought them to have for many, many years, and again, suggesting that the reliance we place upon these agencies is unfounded. And yet, there's a larger case. It's still pending. No oral argument yet scheduled for this. No oral argument on the docket yet, but it's on the docket of the Supreme Court, presumably for argument sometime in early 2024. What is the name of the case? It's Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. Raimondo, R-A-I-M-O-N-D-O, M-O-N-D-O. And it's also consolidated with another case called Relentless versus Commerce Department. And if you're thinking, gee, Relentless sounds like the name of a boat or a ship, the answer is right. Both these cases come out of something called the National Marine Fisheries service. And that service is responsible for ensuring that fishermen out there who are engaged in commercial fishing in our nation and our waterways are abiding by all the laws, or the federal laws that our legislature has imposed. And a part of that is regulations established by law, by the legislature of the National Marine Fisheries Service, provide that on all of these shipping, these fishing boats, these commercial fishing boats that not only fish, but also then ship and bring the fish into port, into shore for consumption by us and other people around the face of the planet, that they comply with basic fishing boat regulations, including other things established by the legislature. There are things called compliance reviews, and those are administered by compliance monitors who are quite literally on the commercial fisher boats. And the question here is not whether their activities are legitimate, but who pays for those compliance monitors. And the issue here is whether or not the interpretation given by the National Marine Fisheries Service that it is the commercial fishermen who are obliged to pay for those compliance monitors, whether that particular decision by the agency is legitimate or not. And so they went into court, in this case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, again, the relentless case as well, and said, you know what, we're challenging that imposition of financial responsibility on us to pay for these compliance monitors on our fishing boats. And along the way, they said, not only is that inappropriate, but by the way, we think that the entire deference given by the federal courts to something like a federal agency called the National Marine Fisheries Service here, that the deference given to that agency in saying, yes, indeed, the fishermen themselves have to pay for these monitors, that's inappropriate. And it goes back to a doctrine called the Chevron Doctrine, Chevron, C-H-E-V-R-O-N versus N-R-D-C. What is the Chevron Doctrine? Basically, it says that the notion is that when ruling on an administrative agency's regulation, here involving fishermen, that is not directly addressed by the legislation that the agency is supposed to be enforcing, the courts generally defer. They basically say, you know what, we're going to give deference to those agency people. As long as that deference is reasonable, we're going to side with the scientists, the fact finders, the people who know about these cases in issuing our decisions. That's called Chevron deference. And for the first time in 40 years, which has been animating decisions by our not only our federal courts, but also administrative agencies as well. For the first time in this case called Raimondo and also Relentless, the Supreme Court is going to determine whether or not that historical judicial deference to agencies, in this case, the NMFS, but could apply to all sorts of other agencies out there. This Chevron deference where we say, yes, we've got people out there who know what this is all about. We do not have the expertise, whether that deference is appropriate and whether or not that basic concept should be overturned by the Supreme Court, basically vesting in our federal district court judges, our appellate court judges, arguably the Supreme Court itself, the authority to substitute its own views about things that are within a particular area of expertise. All of that coming up in these cases called Raimondo and also Relentless, to be scheduled and heard by the United States Supreme Court in the weeks ahead, again, focusing on administrative agencies. We're going to be talking about all of that. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court as well in our future broadcasts, including a very special broadcast we have coming up on the 75th anniversary of our broadcast. That's going to be December 9th. Tune in for that special program here on the stations of Civic Media for today. Thank you so much for joining me, for joining Anya for our discussion of all of these issues in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in these United States of America. Have a good week, everybody.
Tell a friend what's on tap.
There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Gillette Intimate gives guys a gentle and easy shave on there. And around there. And even under there.
Don't treat your groin like junk. Respect it with Gillette Intimate, the best a man can get. Buy now at a retailer near you.
Temperatures getting low, but demand remains high? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. And Indeed's interview tool lets you schedule and conduct virtual interviews right from their website. Visit Indeed.com/credits.
Your hometown radio refreshed. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Peter King.